He sat his saddle as if he'd been born there, tall, slim, graceful. A cloak of pale red silk fluttered from his shoulders, and his shirt was armoured with overlapping rows of copper discs that glittered like a thousand bright new pennies as he rode. His high gilded helm displayed a copper sun on its brow, and the round shield slung behind him bore the sun and spear of House Martell on its polished metal surface. A Martell son, but 10 years too young, Tyrion thought as he reined up. Too fit as well, and far too fierce. He knew what he must deal with by then. How many Dornishmen does it take to start a war? He asked himself. Only one. Yet he had no choice but to smile. Well met, my lords. We had word of your approach, and his grace King Joffrey bid me ride out to welcome you in his name. My lord father, the king's son, sends his greetings as well. He feigned an amiable confusion. Which of you is Prince Doran? My brother's health requires he remain at Sunspear. The princeling removed his helm. Beneath his face was lined and saturnine, with thin arched brows above large eyes as black and shiny as pools of coal oil. Only a few streaks of silver marred the lustrous black hair that receded from his brow in a widow's peak as sharply pointed as his nose. A sorte Dornishman for certain. Prince Doran has sent me to join King Joffrey's council in his stead, as it please his grace. His grace will be most honoured to have the counsel of a warrior as renowned as Prince Oberon of Dorne, said Tyrion, thinking, this will mean blood in the gutters. And your noble companions are most welcome as well. Permit me to acquaint you with them, my lord of Lannister. Sir Deziel Dot of Lemonwood, Lord Tremont Gergalen, Lord Harmon Uller and his brother Sir Ulwick, Sir Ryan Illyrian and his natural son Sir Daemon Sand, the bastard of God's Grease, Lord Dagus Manwoody, his brother Sir Giles, his sons Mors and Dickon, Sir Aaron Corgyle, and let it never be thought that I would neglect the ladies, Miria Jordain, heir to the Tor, Lady Lara Blackmont, her daughter Janessa, her son Pyrrhus. He raised a slender hand toward a black-haired woman to the rear, beckoning her forward. And this is Illyria Sand, mine own paramour. Tyrion swallowed a groan. His paramour, and bastard born, Cersei will pitch a holy fit if he wants her at the wedding. If she consigned the woman to some dark corner below the salt, his sister would risk the red viper's wrath. Seat her beside him at the high table, and every other lady on the dais was like to take offence. Did Prince Doran mean to provoke a quarrel? Prince Oberon wheeled his horse about to face his fellow Dornishmen. Illyria, lords and ladies, sirs, see how well King Joffrey loves us. His grace has been so kind as to send his own uncle Imp to bring us to his court. Bronn snorted back laughter, and Tyrion perforce must feign amusement as well. Not alone, my lords, that would be too enormous a task for a little man like me. His own party had come up on them, as though it was his turn to name the names. Let me present Sir Flemont Brax, heir to Ornvale, Lord Giles of Rusby, Sir Adam Marbrand, Lord Commander of the City Watch, Jalabar Zoe, a Prince of the Red Flower Vale, Sir Harry Swift, my uncle Kevin's good father by marriage, Sir Merlin Craighall, Sir Philip Foote, and Sir Bronn of the Blackwater, two heroes of our recent battle against the rebel Stannis Baratheon, and my own squire, young Podrick of House Payne. The names had a nice ringing sound as Tyrion reeled them off, but the bearers were nowise near as distinguished nor formidable a company as those who accompanied Prince Oberon, as both of them knew full well.
"My Lord of Lannister," said Lady Blackmont, "we have come a long dusty way, and rest and refreshment would be most welcome. Might we continue on to the city?"
"At once, my lady,"
Tyrion turned his horse's head and called to Sir Adam Marbrant. The mounted go-cloaks who formed the greatest part of his honour guard turned their horses crisply at Sir Adam's command, and the column set off for the river and King's Landing beyond.
"Oberon, Nymeres, Martell," Tyrion muttered under his breath as he fell in beside the man. "The red viper of dawn. And what in the seven hells am I supposed to do with him?"
He knew the man only by reputation, to be sure, but the reputation was fearsome. When he was no more than 16, Prince Oberon had been found abed with a paramour of old Lord Ironwood, a huge man of fierce repute and short temper. A duel ensued, though in view of the prince's youth and high birth, it was only to first blood. Both men took cuts, and honour were satisfied. Yet Prince Oberon soon recovered, while Lord Ironwood's wounds festered and killed him. Afterward, men whispered that Oberon had fought with a poisoned sword, and ever thereafter, friends and foes alike called him the Red Viper. That was many years ago, to be sure. The boy of 16 was a man past 40 now, and his legend had grown a deal darker. He had travelled in the free cities, learning the poisoner's trade, and perhaps arts darker still, if rumours could be believed. He had studied at the Citadel, going so far as to forge 6 links of a maester's chain before he grew bored. He had soldiered in the disputed lands across the narrow sea, riding with the second sons for a time before forming his own company. His tourneys, his battles, his duels, his horses, his carnality. It was said that he had bedded men and women both, and had begotten bastard girls all over Dawn. The Sand Snakes, men called his daughters. So far as Tyrion had heard, Prince Oberon had never fathered a son. And, of course, he had crippled the heir to Highgarden. "There is no man in the Seven Kingdoms who will be less welcome at a Tyrell wedding," thought Tyrion. To send Prince Oberon to King's Landing, while the city still hosted Lord Mace Tyrell, 2 of his sons, and thousands of their men-at-arms, was a provocation as dangerous as Prince Oberon himself. "A wrong word, an ill-timed jest, a look. That's all it would take, and our noble allies will be at one another's throats." "We have met before," the Dornish prince said lightly to Tyrion, as they rode side by side along the King's Road, past ashen fields and the skeletons of trees. "I would not expect you to remember, though. You were even smaller than you are now." There was a mocking edge to his voice that Tyrion misliked, but he was not about to let the Dornishman provoke him. "When was this, my lord?" he asked in tones of polite interest. "Oh, many and many a year ago, when my mother ruled in Dorne, and your lord father was hand to a different king." "Not so different as you might think," reflected Tyrion. "It was when I visited Casterly Rock with my mother, her consort, and my sister Elian. I was, 14, 15, thereabouts. Ilya a year older. Your brother and sister were 8 or 9, as I recall, and you had just been born." "A queer time to come visiting." His mother had died giving him birth, so the Martells would have found the rock deep in mourning. His father especially. Lord Tywin seldom spoke of his wife, but Tyrion had heard his uncles talk of the love between them. In those days his father had been Aerys' hand, and many people said that Lord Tywin Lannister ruled the Seven Kingdoms, but Lady Joanna ruled Lord Tywin. "He was not the same man after she died, imp," his uncle Gerry told him once. "The best part of him died with her." Geryon had been the youngest of Lord Tytus Lannister's 4 sons, and the uncle Tyrion liked best. But he was gone now, lost beyond the seas, and Tyrion himself had put Lady Joanna in her grave. "Did you find Casterly Rock to your liking, my lord?" "Scarcely. Your father ignored us the whole time we were there, after commanding Sir Kevin to see to our entertainments. The cell they gave me had a feather bed to sleep in, in mirrorish carpets on the floor, but it was dark and windowless, much like a dungeon when you come down to it, as I told Elia at the time. Your skies were too grey, your wines too sweet, your women too chaste, your food too bland, and you yourself were the greatest disappointment of all. I had just been born. What did you expect of me? Enormity, the black-haired prince replied. You were small, but far famed. We were in Old Town at your birth, and all the city talked of was the monster that had been born to the king's hand, and what such an omen might foretell for the realm. Famine, plague, and war, no doubt, Tyrion gave a sour smile. It's always famine, plague, and war. Oh, and winter, and the long night that never ends. All that, said Prince Oberyn, and your father's fall as well. Lord Tywin had made himself greater than King Aerys, I heard one begging brother preach. But only a god is meant to stand above a king. You were his curse, a punishment sent by the gods to teach him that he was no better than any other man. I try, but he refuses to learn. Tyrion gave a sigh. But do go on. I pray you. I love a good tale. And well you might, since you were said to have one. A stiff, curly tail like a swine's. Your head was monstrous huge, we heard. Half again the size of your body. And you had been born with thick black hair and a beard besides. An evil eye and lion's claws, yet teeth were so long you could not close your mouth. And between your legs were a girl's privates as well as a boy's. A life would be much simpler if men could fuck themselves, don't you agree? And I can think of a few times when claws and teeth might have proved useful. Even so, I begin to see the nature of your complaint. Bronn gave out with a chuckle, but Oberyn only smiled. We might never have seen you at all but for your sweet sister. You were never seen at table or hall, though sometimes at night we could hear a baby howling down in the depths of the rock. You did have a monstrous great voice, I must grant you that. You would wail for hours, and nothing would quiet you but a woman's tit. Still true, as it happens. This time Prince Oberyn did laugh. As a taste we share. Lord Gargalen once told me he hoped to die with a sword in his hand, to which I replied that I would sooner go with a breast in mine. Tyrion had to grin. You were speaking of my sister?
Cersei promised Elia to show you to us. The day before we were to sail, whilst my mother and your father were clustered together, she and Jamie took us down to your nursery. Your wet nurse tried to send us off, but your sister was having none of that. He's mine, she said, and you're just a milk cow. You can't tell me what to do. Be quiet, or I'll have my father cut your tongue out. A cow doesn't need a tongue, only udders.
Her grace learned charm at an early age, said Tyrion, amused by the notion of his sister claiming him as hers. She's never been in any rush to claim me since, the gods know.
Cersei even undid your swaddling clothes to give us a better look, the Dornish prince continued. You did have one evil eye and some black fuzz on your scalp. Perhaps your head was larger than most, but there was no tail, no beard, neither teeth nor claws, and nothing between your legs but a tiny pink cock. After all the wonderful whispers, Lord Tywin's doom turned out to be just a hideous red infant with stunted legs. Elia even made the noise that young girls make at the sight of infants. I'm sure you've heard it. The same noise they make over cute kittens and playful puppies. I believe she wanted to nurse you herself, ugly as you were. When I commented that you seemed a poor sort of monster, your sister said, "He killed my mother," and twisted your little cock so hard I thought she was like to pull it off. You shrieked, but it was only when your brother Jamie said, "Leave him be, you're hurting him," that Cersei let go of you. "It doesn't matter," she told us. "Everyone says he's like to die soon. He shouldn't have even lived this long.
The sun was shining bright above them, and the day was pleasantly warm for autumn. But Tyrion Lannister went cold all over when he heard that.
My sweet sister. He scratched at the scar of his nose and gave the Dornish man a taste of his evil eye. Now, why would he tell such a tale? Is he testing me, or simply twisting my cock as Cersei did, so he can hear me scream?
Be sure and tell that story to my father. It will delight him as much as it did me, the part about my tail especially. I did have one, but he had it lopped off.
Prince Oberyn had a chuckle.
You've grown more amusing since last we met.
Yes, but I meant to grow taller.
While we're speaking of amusement, I heard a curious tale from Lord Buckler Stewart. He claimed that you had put a tax on women's privy purses.
It's a tax on whoring, said Tyrion, irritated all over again. And it was my bloody father's notion.
Only a penny for each act. The king's hand felt it might help improve the morals of the city, and pay for Joffrey's wedding besides.
Needless to say, as master of coin, Tyrion had gotten all the blame for it. Bronn said they were calling it the dwarf's penny in the streets.
Spread your legs for the half-man now, they were shouting in the brothels and wine sinks, if the sellsword could be believed.
I will make certain to keep my pouch full of pennies. Even a prince must pay his taxes.
Why should you need to go whoring?
He glanced back to where Ilaria Sand rode among the other women.
Did you tire of your paramour on the road?
Never. We share too much, Prince Oberyn shrugged. We have never shared a beautiful blonde woman, however, and Ilaria is curious. Do you know of such a creature?
I am a man wedded, though not yet bedded. I no longer frequent whores, unless I want to see them hanged.
Oberyn abruptly changed the subject.
It is said there are to be 77 dishes served at the king's wedding feast. Are you hungry, my prince?
I have hungered for a long time, though not for food. Pray tell me, when will the justice be served?
A justice?
Yes, that is why he's here. I should have seen that at once.
You were close to your sister.
As children, Elia and I were inseparable, much like your own brother and sister.
Gods, I hope not.
Wars and weddings have kept us well occupied, Prince Oberyn. I fear no one has yet had the time to look into murders 16 years stale, dreadful as they were. We shall, of course, just as soon as we may. Any help the Dawn might be able to provide to restore the king's peace would only hasten the beginning of my lord father's inquiry.
Dwarf, said the Red Viper in a tone grown markedly less cordial, spare me your Lannister lies. Is it sheep you take us for, or fools? My brother is not a bloodthirsty man, but neither has he been asleep for 16 years. John Arryn came to Sunspear the year after Robert took the throne, and you can be sure that he was questioned closely. Him, and 100 more. I did not come for some mummer's show of an inquiry. I came for justice, for Elia and her children, and I will have it. Starting with this lummox, Gregor Clegane, but not, I think, ending there. Before he dies, the enormity that rides will tell me whence came his orders. Please assure your lord father of that.
He smiled.
An old Septon once claimed I was living proof of the goodness of the gods. Do you know why that is, imp?
No,
Tyrion admitted warily.
Why, if the gods were cruel, they would have made me my mother's firstborn and Dorne her third. I am a bloodthirsty man, you see. And it is me you must contend with now, not my patient, prudent, and gouty brother.
Tyrion could see the sun shining on the Blackwater Rush half a mile ahead, and on the walls and towers and hills of King's Landing beyond.
He glanced over his shoulder at the glittering column following them up the King's Road.
"You speak like a man with a great host at his back," he said. "Yet all I see are 300. Do you spy that city there, north of the river?"
"The mitten heap you call King's Landing. That's the very one. Not only do I see it, I believe I smell it now."
"Then take a good sniff, my lord. Fill up your nose. Half a million people sink more than 300, you'll find. Do you smell the gold cloaks? There are near 5,000 of them. My father's own sworn swords must account for another 20,000. And then there are the roses. Roses smell so sweet, don't they? Especially when there are so many of them. 50, 60, 70,000 roses in the city or camped outside it. I can't really say how many are left, but there's more than I care to count anyway."
Martell gave a shrug. "In Durn of old, before we married Dirren, it was said that all flowers bow before the sun. Should the roses seek to hinder me, I'll gladly trample them underfoot."
"As you trampled Willis Tyrell?"
The Dornishman did not react as expected.
"I had a letter from Willis, not a half year past. We share an interest in fine horseflesh. He has never borne me any ill will for what happened in the lists. I struck his breastplate clean, but his foot caught in a stirrup as he fell, and his horse came down on top of him. I sent a maester to him afterwards, but it was all he could do to save the boy's leg. The knee was far past mending. If any were to blame, it was his fool of a father. Willis Tyrell was green as his surcoat, and he had no business riding in such company. The fat flower thrust him into tourneys at too tender an age, just as he did with the other two. He wanted another Leo Longthorn, and made himself a cripple.
There are those who say Sir Loras is better than Leo Longthorn ever was," said Tyrion.
"Renly's little ruse? I doubt that."
"I doubt it all you wish," said Tyrion. "But Sir Loras has defeated many good knights, including my brother Jamie."
"By defeated you mean unhorsed in tourney. Tell me who is slain in battle, if you mean to frighten me."
"Sir Robar Royce and Sir Eamon Kai for two. And men say he performed prodigious feats of valour on the Blackwater, fighting beside Lord Renly's ghost."
"So these same men who saw such prodigious feats saw the ghost as well, yes?"
The Dornishman laughed lightly. Tyrion gave him a long look.
"Shatayas on the Street of Silk has several girls who might suit your needs. Dancia's hair the colour of honey. Mariah's is pale white gold. I would advise you to keep one or the other by your side at all times, my lord."
"At all times?" Prince Oberon lifted a thin black eyebrow.
"And why is that, my good imp?"
"You want to die with a breast in hand," you said. Tyrion cantered on ahead to where the ferry barges waited on the south bank of the Blackwater. He had suffered all he meant to suffer of what passed for Dornish wit.
"Father should have sent Joffrey after all. He could have asked Prince Oberon if he knew how a Dornish man differed from a cowflop."
That made him grin, despite himself. He would have to make a point of being on hand when the Red Viper was presented to the king. Arya. The man on the roof was the first to die. He was crouched down by the chimney, 200 yards away, no more than a vague shadow in the pre-dawn gloom. But as the sky began to lighten, he stirred, stretched, and stood. Angai's arrow took him in the chest. He tumbled bonelessly down the steep slate pitch and fell in front of the septory door. The mummers had posted two guards there, but their torch left them night-blind, and the outlaws had crept in close. Kyle and Notch let fly together. One man went down with an arrow through his throat, the other through his belly. The second man dropped the torch,
and the flames licked up at him. He screamed as his clothes caught fire, and that was the end of stealth. Thoris gave a shout, and the outlaws attacked in earnest. Arya watched from atop her horse. On the crest of the wooded ridge that overlooked the Septry mill, brewhouse and stables, and the desolation of weeds, burnt trees, and mud that surrounded them. The trees were mostly bare now, and the few withered brown leaves that still clung to the branches did little to obstruct her view. Lord Beric had left beardless Dick and Mudge to guard them. Arya hated being left behind like she was some stupid child, but at least Gentry had been kept back as well. She knew better than to try and argue. This was battle, and in battle you had to obey. The eastern horizon glowed gold and pink, and overhead a half-moon peeked out through low, scuttling clouds. The wind blew cold, and Arya could hear the rush of water and the creak of the mill's great wooden water-wheel. There was a smell of rain in the dawn air, but no drops were falling yet. Flaming arrows flew through the morning mists, trailing pale ribbons of fire and thudded into the wooden walls of the Septry. A few smashed through shuttered windows, and soon enough thin tendrils of smoke were rising between the broken shutters. Two mummers came bursting from the Septry, side by side, axes in their hands. Engai and the other archers were waiting. One axeman died at once. The other managed to duck, so the shaft ripped through his shoulder. He staggered on till two more arrows found him. So quickly it was hard to say which had struck first. The long shafts punched through his breastplate as if it had been made of silk instead of steel. He fell heavily. Engai had arrows tipped with bodkins as well as broadheads. A bodkin could pierce even heavy plate. "I'm going to learn to shoot a bow," Arya thought. She loved sword fighting, but she could see how arrows were good too. Flames were creeping up the west wall of the Septry, and thick smoke poured through a broken window. A Moorish crossbowman poked his head out a different window, got off a bolt, and ducked down to rewind. She could hear fighting from the stables as well, shouts well mingled with the screams of horses and the clang of steel. "Kill them all," she thought fiercely. She bit her lip so hard she tasted blood. "Kill every single one." The crossbowman appeared again, but no sooner had he loosed than three arrows hissed past his head. One rattled off his helm. He vanished, bow and all. Arya could see flames in several of the second-story windows. Between the smoke and the morning mist, the air was a haze of blowing black and white. Engai and the other bowmen were creeping closer, the better to find targets. Then the Septry erupted, the mummers boiling out like angry ants. Two ebonies rushed through the door with shaggy brown shields held high before them, and behind them came a Dothraki with a great curved arrack and bells in his braid, and behind him three Volantine sellswords covered with fierce tattoos. Others were climbing out of windows and leaping to the ground. Arya saw a man take an arrow through the chest with one leg across a windowsill and heard his scream as he fell. The smoke was thickening. Quarrels and arrows sped back and forth. Watty fell with a grunt, his bow slipping from his hand. Kyle was trying to knock another shaft to his string when a man in black mail flung a spear through his belly. She heard Lord Beric shout. From out of the ditches and trees, the rest of his band came pouring, steel in hand. Arya saw Lem's bright yellow cloak flapping behind him as he rode down the man who'd killed Kyle. Thoris and Lord Beric were everywhere, their swords swirling fire. The Red Priest hacked at a hide shield until it flew to pieces, while his horse kicked the man in the face. A Dothraki screamed and charged the Lightning Lord, and the flaming sword leapt out to meet his arrack. The blades kissed and spun and kissed again. Then the Dothraki's hair was ablaze, and a moment later he was dead. She spied Ned, too, fighting at the Lightning Lord's side. "It's not fair. He's only a little older than me. They should have let me fight." The battle did not last very long. The brave companions, still on their feet, soon died, or threw down their swords. Two of the Dothraki managed to regain their horses and flee, but only because Lord Beric let them go. "Let them carry the word back to Harrenhal," he said with flaming sword in hand.
It will give the leech lord and his goat a few more sleepless nights. Jack be lucky, Harwin, and Merito Moontan brave the burning septree to search for captives. They emerge from the smoke and flames a few moments later with 8 brown brothers, one so weak that Merit had to carry him across his shoulder. There was a septon with them as well, round-shouldered and balding, but he wore black chainmail over his grey robes.
"Found him hiding under the cellar steps," said Jack Coffin.
Thora smiled to see him.
"You are Ut, a septon Ut, a man of God." "What god would want the likes of you?" growled Lem. "I have sinned," the septon wailed. I know, forgive me, father. Oh, grievously have I sinned."
Arya remembered Septon Ut from her time at Harrenhal. Shagwell the Fool said he always wept and prayed for forgiveness after he'd killed his latest boy. Sometimes he even made the other mummers scourge him, though all thought that was very funny. Lord Beric slammed his sword into his scabbard, quenching the flames. "Give the dying the gift of mercy, and bind the others hand and foot for trial," he commanded, and it was done. The trials went swiftly. Various of the outlaws came forward to tell of things the brave companions had done, towns and villages sacked, crops burned, women raped and murdered, men maimed and tortured. A few spoke of the boys that Septon Ut had carried off. The septon wept and prayed through it all.
"I am a weak reed," he told Lord Beric. "I prayed to the warrior for strength, but the gods made me weak. Have mercy on my weakness. The boys, the sweet boys, I never mean to hurt them."
Septon Ut soon dangled beneath the tall elm, swinging slowly by the neck, as naked as his name day. The other brave companions followed one by one. A few fought, kicking and struggling, as the noose tightened around their throats. One of the crossbowmen kept shouting,
"Aye, soldier! Aye, soldier!"
in a thick Moorish accent. Another offered to lead his captors to gold. A third told them what a good outlaw he would make. Each was stripped and bound, and hanged in turn. Tom Sevenstrings played a dirge for them on his wood harp, and Thoris implored the Lord of Light to roast their souls until the end of time. A mama tree, Arya thought, as she watched them dangle, their pale skins painted a sullen red by the flames of the burning septree. Already the crows were coming, appearing out of nowhere. She heard them croaking and cackling at one another, and wondered what they were saying. Arya had not feared Septon Ut as much as she did Rorg and Biter and some of the others still at Harrenhal, but she was glad that he was dead all the same. They should have hanged the hound too, or chopped his head off. Instead, to her disgust, the outlaws had treated Sandor Clegane's burned arm, restored his sword and horse and armour, and set him free a few miles from the Hollow Hill. All they'd taken was his gold. The septree soon collapsed in a roar of smoke and flame, its walls no longer able to support the weight of its heavy slate roof. The 8 brown brothers watched with resignation. "They were all that remained," explained the eldest, who wore a small iron hammer on a thong about his neck to signify his devotion to the smith.
"Before the war, we were 40, and it was a prosperous place. We had 12 milk cows and a bull, 100 beehives, a vineyard, and an apple arbour. But when the lions came through, they took all our wine and milk and honey, slaughtered the cows, and put our vineyard to the torch. After that, I've lost count of our visitors. This false septon was only the latest. There was one monster. We gave him all our silver, but he was certain we were hiding gold, so his men killed us one by one to make elder brother talk."
"And how did the 8 of you survive?" asked Angai the archer.
"I'm ashamed," the old man said. "It was me. When it came my turn to die,
I told them where our gold was hidden.
Brother, said Thoris of Myr, the only shame was not telling them at once. The outlaws sheltered that night in the brewhouse beneath the little river. Their host had a cache of food hidden beneath the floor of the stables, so they shared a simple supper, oaten bread, onions, and a watery cabbage soup, tasting faintly of garlic. Arya found a slice of carrot floating in her bowl and counted herself lucky. The brothers never asked the outlaws for names. They know, Arya thought. How could they not? Lord Beric wore the lightning bolt on his breastplate, shield and cloak, and Thoris his red robes, or what remained of them. One brother, a young novice, was bold enough to tell the Red Priest not to pray to his false god so long as he was under their roof.
"Bugger that," said Lem Lemoncloak. "He's our god, too, and you owe us for your bloody lives. And what's false about him? Might be your smith can mend a broken sword, but can he heal a broken man?"
"Enough, Lem," Lord Beric commanded. "Beneath their roof we will honour their rules. The sun will not cease to shine if we miss a prayer or two," Thoris agreed mildly. "I am one who would know." Lord Beric himself did not eat. Arya had never seen him eat, though from time to time he took a cup of wine. He did not seem to sleep either. His good eye would often close, as if from weariness, but when you spoke to him it would flick open again at once. The marcher lord was still clad in his ratty black cloak and dented breastplate with its chipped enamel lightning. He even slept in that breastplate. The dull, black steel hid the terrible wound the hound had given him, the same way his thick woolen scarf concealed the dark ring about his throat. But nothing hid his broken head. All caved in at the temple, or the raw red pit that was his missing eye, or the shape of the skull beneath his face. Arya looked at him warily, remembering all the tales told of him in Harrenhal. Lord Beric seemed to sense her fear. He turned his head and beckoned her closer.
"Do I frighten you, child?"
"No," she chewed her lip. "Only, well, I thought the hound had killed you, but—"
"A wound," said Lem Lemoncloak. "A grievous wound, aye, but Thoris healed it. There's never been no better healer."
Lord Beric gazed at Lem with a queer look in his good eye, and no look at all in the other, only scars and dried blood.
"No better healer," he agreed wearily. "Lem, past time to change the watch, I'd think. See to it, if you'd be so good." "Aye, my lord."
Lem's big yellow cloak swirled behind him as he strode out into the windy night. Even brave men blind themselves sometimes when they are afraid to see, Lord Beric said when Lem had gone. "Thoris, how many times have you brought me back now?" The Red Priest bowed his head.
"It is R'hllor who brings you back, my lord, the Lord of Light. I am only his instrument." "How many times?"
Lord Beric insisted.
6, Thoris said reluctantly, "and each time is harder. You have grown reckless, my lord. Is death so very sweet?"
"Sweet? No, my friend, not sweet."
"Then do not court it so. Lord Tywin leads from the rear. Lord Stannis as well. You would be wise to do the same. A seventh death might mean the end of both of us."
Lord Beric touched the spot above his left ear where his temple was caved in. "Here is where Sir Burton Crakehall broke helm and head with a blow of his mace." He unwound his scarf, exposing the black bruise that encircled his neck. "Here, the mark the manticore made at Rushing Falls." He seized a poor beekeeper and his wife, thinking they were mine, and let it be known far and wide that he would hang them both unless I gave myself up to him. When I did, he hanged them anyway, and me on the gibbet between them. He lifted a finger to the raw red pit of his eye. "Here is where the mountain thrust his dirk through my visor." A weary smile brushed his lips. "That's thrice
I have died at the hands of House Clegane. You would think I might have learned.
It was a jest, Arya knew, but Thoris did not laugh. He put a hand on Lord Beric's shoulder.
Best not to dwell on it.
Can I dwell on what I scarce remember? I held a castle on the marches once, and there was a woman I was pledged to marry. But I could not find that castle today, nor tell you the colour of that woman's hair. Who knighted me, old friend? What were my favourite foods? It all fades. Sometimes I think I was born on the bloody grass of that grove of ash, with a taste of fire in my mouth and a hole in my chest. Are you my mother, Thoris?
Arya stared at the Mirish priest, all shaggy hair and pink rags and bits of old armour. Grey stubble covered his cheeks and the sagging skin beneath his chin. He did not look much like the wizards in old Nan's stories, but even so,
could you bring back a man without a head?
Arya asked.
Just the once, not six times. Could you?
I have no magic, child, only prayers. That first time, his lordship had a hole right through him and blood in his mouth. I knew there was no hope. So when his poor torn chest stopped moving, I gave him the good God's own kiss to send him on his way. I filled my mouth with fire and breathed the flames inside him, down his throat to lungs and heart and soul. The last kiss, it is called, and many a time I saw the old priests bestow it on the Lord's servants as they died. I had given it a time or two myself, as all priests must, but never before had I felt a dead man shudder as the fire filled him, nor seen his eyes come open. It was not me who raised him, my lady. It was the Lord. Rilor is not done with him yet. Life is warmth, and warmth is fire, and fire is God's, and God's alone.
Arya felt tears well in her eyes. Thoris used a lot of words, but all they meant was no. That much she understood.
Your father was a good man, Lord Beric said. Harwin has told me much of him. For his sake, I would gladly forego your ransom, but we need the gold too desperately. She chewed her lip.
That's true, I guess.
He had given the Hound's gold to Greenbeard and the Huntsman to buy provisions south of the Mander, she knew.
The last harvest burned. This one is drowning, and winter will soon be on us, she had heard him say when he sent them off. The small folk need grain and seed, and we need blades and horses. Too many of my men ride Ramses, drays, and mules against foes mounted on coursers and destriers.
Arya did not know how much Rob would pay for her, though. He was a king now, not the boy she'd left at Winterfell, with snow melting in his hair. And if he knew the things she'd done, the stable boy and the guard at Harrenhal and all,
what if my brother doesn't want to ransom me?
Why would you think that? Asked Lord Beric.
Well, Arya said, my hair's messy, and my nails are dirty, and my feet are all hard.
Rob wouldn't care about that, probably, but her mother would. Lady Catelyn always wanted her to be like Sansa, to sing and dance and sew and mind her courtesies. Just thinking of it made Arya try to comb her hair with her fingers, but it was all tangles and mats, and all she did was to tear some out.
I ruined that gown that Lady Smallwood gave me, and I don't sew so good.
She chewed her lip.
I don't sew very well, I mean. Septim Ordain used to say I had a blacksmith's hands.
Gendry hooted.
Those soft little things, he called out. You couldn't even hold a hammer. I could, if I wanted, she snapped at him.
Thoris chuckled.
Your brother will pay, child. Have no fear on that count. Yes, but what if he won't? She insisted.
Lord Beric sighed.
Then I will send you to Lady Smallwood for a time, or perhaps to mine own castle of Blackhaven.
but that will not be necessary, I'm certain. I do not have the power to give you back your father, no more than Thoris does, but I can at least see that you are returned safely to your mother's arms.
Do you swear?
She asked him. Jorun had promised to take her home too, only he'd gotten killed instead. On my honour as a knight, the Lightning Lord said solemnly. It was raining when Lem returned to the brewhouse, muttering curses as water ran off his yellow cloak to puddle on the floor. Anguy and Jack Be Lucky sat by the door rolling dice, but no matter which game they played, One-Eye Jack had no luck at all. Tom Sevenstrings replaced a string on his wood harp and sang The Mother's Tears. When Willem's wife was wet, Lord Hart rode out on a rainy day, and then the rains of Castamere.
And who are you, the proud lord said, that I must bow so low? Only a cat of a different coat, that's all the truth I know. In a coat of gold or a coat of red, a lion still has its claws, and mine are long and sharp, my lord, as long and sharp as yours. And so he spoke, and so he spoke, that lord of Castamere. But now the rains weep o'er his hall, with no one there to hear. Yes, now the rains weep o'er his hall, and not a soul to hear.
Finally, Tom ran out of rain songs and put away his harp. Then there was only the sound of the rain itself beating down on the slate roof of the brewhouse. The dice game ended, and Arya stood on one leg and then the other, listening to Merritt complain about his horse throwing a shoe.
"I could shoe him for you," said Gendry all of a sudden. "I was only apprentice, but my master said my hand was made to hold a hammer. I can shoe horses, close up rents in mail, and beat the dents from plate. I bet I could make swords, too."
"What are you saying, lad?" said Harwin.
"I'll smith for you." Gentry went to one knee before Lord Beric. "If you'll have me, my lord, I could be of use. I've made tools and knives, and once I made a helmet that wasn't so bad. One of the mountain's men stole it from me when we were taken."
Arya bit her lip. "He means to leave me too."
"You would do better serving Lord Tully at Riverrun," said Lord Beric. "I cannot pay for your work." "No one ever did. I want a forge and food to eat, some place I can sleep. That's enough, my lord."
"A smith can find a welcome most anywhere, a skilled armourer even more so. Why would you choose to stay with us?"
Arya watched Gendry screw up his stupid face, thinking.
"At the Hollow Hill, what you said about being King Robert's men and brothers, I like that. I like that you gave the hound a trial. Lord Bolton just hanged folk or took off their heads, and Lord Tywin and Sir Aemery were the same. I'd sooner smith for you." "We've got plenty of mail needs mending, my lord," Jack reminded Lord Beric. "Most we took off the dead, and there's holes where the death came through."
"You must be a lackwit boy," said Lem.
"We're outlaws, low-born scum, most of us, excepting his lordship. Don't think it'll be like Tom's fool sons, neither. You won't be stealing no kisses from a princess, nor riding in no tawnies in stolen armour. You join us, you'll end up with your neck in a noose, or your head mounted up above some castle gate." "It's no more than they'd do for you," said Gendry. "Aye, that's so," said Jack Be Lucky cheerfully. "The crows await us all. My lord, the boy seems brave enough, and we do have need of what he brings us. Take him," says Jack.
"And quick," suggested Harwin, chuckling, "before the fever passes and he comes back to his senses."
A wan smile crossed Lord Beric's lips.
"Thoris, my sword."
This time the Lightning Lord did not set the blade afire, but merely laid it light on Gendry's shoulder.
"Gendry, d'ye swear before the eyes of gods and men to defend those who cannot defend themselves, to protect all women and children,
to obey your captains, your liege lord, and your king, to fight bravely when needed, and to do such other tasks as are laid upon you, however hard or humble or dangerous they may be.
I do, my lord.
The marcher lord moved the sword from the right shoulder to the left, and said, Arise, Sir Gendry, Knight of the Hollow Hill, and be welcome to our brotherhood. From the door came rough, rasping laughter. The rain was running off him. His burned arm was wrapped in leaves and linen and bound tight against his chest by a crude rope sling, but the older burns that marked his face glistened black and slick in the glow of their little fire.
"Making more knights, Dondarrion," the intruder said in a growl. "I ought to kill you all over again for that."
Lord Beric faced him coolly.
"I'd hoped we'd seen the last of you, Clegane. How did you come to find us?" "It wasn't hard. You made enough bloody smoke to be seen in Oldtown."
"What's become of the sentries I posted?" Clegane's mouth twitched.
"Those two blind men. Might be I killed them both. What would you do if I had?"
Angai strung his bow. Notch was doing the same.
"Do you wish to die so very much, Sandor?" asked Thoris. "You must be mad or drunk to follow us here."
"Drunk on rain? You didn't leave me enough gold to buy a cup of wine, you horsens."
Angai drew an arrow.
"We're outlaws. Outlaws steal. It's in the songs. If you ask nice, Tom may sing you one. Be thankful we didn't kill you."
"Come try it, archer. I'll take the quiver off you and shove those arrows up your freckly little ass."
Angai raised his longbow, but Lord Beric lifted a hand before he could loose.
"Why did you come here, Clegane?" "To get back what's mine. Your gold. What else? It wasn't for the pleasure of looking at your face, Dondarrion, I'll tell you that. You're uglier than me now. And a robber knight besides, it seems."
"I gave you a note for your gold," Lord Beric said calmly. "A promise to pay when the war's done."
"I want my arse with your paper. I want the gold."
"We don't have it."
"I sent it south with Greenbeard and the huntsman to buy grain and seed across the Mander."
"To feed all them whose crops you burned," said Gendry.
"Is that the tale now?"
Sandor Clegane laughed again.
"As it happens, that's just what I meant to do with it. Feed a bunch of ugly peasants and their poxy whelps."
"You're lying," said Gentry.
"The boy's a mouth on him, I see. Why believe them and not me? Couldn't be my face, could it?"
Clegane glanced at Arya. "You're going to make her a knight too, Dondarrion? The first 8-year-old girl knight?"
"I'm 12, Arya lied loudly, "and I could be a knight if I wanted. I could have killed you too, only Lem took my knife."
Remembering that still made her angry.
"Complain to Lem, not me. Then tuck your tail between your legs and run. Do you know what dogs do to wolves?"
"Next time I will kill you. I'll kill your brother too."
"Now."
His dark eyes narrowed.
"That you won't."
He turned back to Lord Beric.
"Say, make my horse a knight. He never shits in a hall and doesn't kick more than most. He deserves to be knighted. Unless you meant to steal him too."
"Best climb on that horse and go," warned Lem.
"I'll go with me gold. Your own guard said I'm guiltless."
"The Lord of Light gave you back your life," declared Thoris of Myr. "He did not proclaim you Baelor the Blessed come again."
The Red Priest unsheathed his sword, and Arya saw that Jack and Merritt had drawn as well. Lord Beric still held the blade he used to dub Gendry.
"Maybe this time they'll kill him."
The hound's mouth gave another twitch.
"You're no more than common thieves."
Lem glowered.
"Your lion friends ride into some village, take all the food and every coin they find, and call it foraging. The wolves as well, so why not us? No one robbed you, dog. You've just been good and foraged."
Sandor Clegane looked at their faces, every one, as if he were trying to commit them all to memory. Then he walked back out into the darkness and the pouring rain from whence he'd come, with never another word. The outlaws waited, wondering. I'd best go see what he did to our sentries. Harwin took a weary look out the door before he left, to make certain the hound was not lurking just outside. Out of that bloody bastard, get all that gold anyhow, Lem Lemonclerk said, to break the tension. Angai shrugged. He won the Anse Tawny, in King's Landing. The bowman grinned. I won a fair fortune myself, but then I met Dancy, Jade, and Alayaya. They taught me what roast swan tastes like and how to bathe in arbor wine. Pissed it all away, did you? Laughed Harwin. Not all. I bought these boots and this excellent dagger. You ought to have bought some land and made one of them roast swan girls an honest woman, said Jack Belucky. Raised yourself a crop of turnips and a crop of sons. Warrior, defend me. What a waste that would have been to turn my gold to turnips. I like turnips, said Jack, aggrieved. I could do with some mashed turnips right now. Thoris of Myr paid no heed to their banter. The hound has lost more than a few bags of coin, he mused. He has lost his master and kennel as well. He cannot go back to the Lannisters. The young wolf would never have him, nor would his brother be like to welcome him. That gold was all he had left, it seems to me. Bloody hell, said Watty the Miller. He'll come murder us in our sleep for sure, then. No, Lord Beric had sheathed his sword. Sandor Clegane would kill us all gladly, but not in our sleep. Angai, on the morrow, take the rear with Beardless Dick. If you see Clegane still sniffing after us, kill his horse. That's a good horse, Angai protested. Aye, said Lem, it's a bloody rider we should be killing. We could use that horse. I'm with Lem, Nott said. Let me feather the dog a few times, discourage him some. Lord Beric shook his head. Clegane won his life beneath the hollow hill. I will not rob him of it. My lord is wise, Thoris told the others. Brothers are trialed by battle. Is a holy thing. You heard me ask Rallor to take a hand, and you saw his fiery finger snap Lord Beric's sword, just as he was about to make an end of it. The Lord of Light is not yet done with Joffrey's hound, it would seem. Harwin soon returned to the brewhouse. Puddingfoot was sound asleep, but unharmed. Wait till I get hold of him, said Lem. I'll cut him a new bunghole. He could have gotten every one of us killed. No one rested very comfortably that night, knowing that Sandor Clegane was out there in the dark, somewhere close. Arya curled up near the fire, warm and snug, yet sleep would not come. She took out the coin that Jaqen H'ghar had given her and curled her fingers around it as she lay beneath her cloak. It made her feel strong to hold it, remembering how she'd been the ghost in Harrenhal. She could kill with a whisper then. Jaqen was gone, though. He'd left her. Hot Pie left me, too, and now Gendry is leaving. Lommy had died. Yoren had died. Cirio Forel had died. Even her father had died, and Jaqen had given her a stupid iron penny and vanished. Valar Morghulis, she whispered softly, tightening her fist so the hard edges of the coin dug into her palm. Sir Gregor, Dunson, Polliver, Raff the Sweetling, the Tickler and the Hound, Sir Ilion, Sir Merin, King Joffrey, Queen Cersei. Arya tried to imagine how they would look when they were dead, but it was hard to bring their faces to mind. The Hound, she could see, and his brother, the Mountain, and she would never forget Joffrey's face or his mother's. But Raff and Dunson and Polliver were all fading, and even the Tickler, whose looks had been so commonplace. Sleep took her at last, but in the black of night Arya woke again, tingling. The fire had burned down to embers. Mudge stood by the door, and another guard was pacing outside. The rain had stopped, and she could hear wolves howling.
So close, she thought, and so many. They sounded as if they